There's a floral clock in Quirm. It's quite a tourist attraction. It turns out to be not what they expect. Unimaginative municipal authorities throughout the multiverse had made floral clocks, which turn out to be a large clock mechanism buried in a civic flowerbed with the face and numbers picked out in bedding plants. Or methane crystals, or sea anemones. The principle is the same. In any case, it soon fills up with whatever is the local equivalent of fast food boxes and derelict lager cans. But the Quirm clock is simply a round flowerbed, filled with 24 different types of flower, carefully chosen for the regularity of the opening and closing of their petals. As Susan ran past, the purple bindweed was opening and Love in a Spin was closing. This meant that it was about 10:30. The streets were deserted. Quirm wasn't a night town. People who came to Quirm looking for a good time went somewhere else. Quirm was so respectable that even dogs asked permission before going to the lavatory. At least, the streets were almost deserted. Susan fancied she could hear something following her, fast and pattering, moving and dodging across the cobble so quickly that it was never more than a suspicion of a shape. Susan slowed down as she reached the Three Roses Alley. Somewhere in Three Roses near the fish shop, Gloria had said. The gels were not encouraged to know about wizards. They did not figure in Miss Butts's universe. The alley looked alien in the darkness. A torch burned in a bracket at one end. It merely made the shadows darker. And halfway along in the gloom, there was a ladder leaning against the wall and a young woman just preparing to climb it. There was something familiar about her. She looked around as Susan approached and seemed quite pleased to see her.
"Hi," she said. "Got change of a dollar, miss?"
"Pardon?"
"Couple of half dollars will do. Half a dollar is the rate, or I'll take copper. Anything, really."
Sorry. No, I only get 50p a week allowance anyway."
"Blast. Ah, well, nothing for it."
Insofar as Susan could see, the girl did not appear to be the usual sort of young woman who made her living in alleys. She had a kind of well-scrubbed beefiness about her. She looked like a nurse of the sort who assists doctors whose patients occasionally get a bit confused and declare they're a bedspread. She looked familiar, too. The girl took a pair of pliers from a pocket in her dress, shinned up the ladder and climbed in through an upper window. Susan hesitated. The girl had seemed quite businesslike about it all, but in her limited experience, people who climbed ladders to get into houses at night were miscreants whom plucky gels should apprehend, and she might at least have gone to look for a watchman, had it not been for the opening of a door further up the alley. Two men staggered out arm in arm and zigzagged happily towards the main street. Susan stepped back. No one bothered her when she didn't want to be noticed. The men walked through the ladder. Either the men weren't exactly solid, and they certainly sounded solid enough, or there was something wrong with the ladder. But the girl had climbed it, and was now climbing down again, slipping something into her pocket.
"Never even woke up, the little cherub," she said.
"Sorry?" said Susan.
"Didn't have 50p on me," said the girl. She swung the ladder easily up onto her shoulder. "Rules are rules. I had to take another tooth."
"Pardon?"
"It's all audited, you see. I'd be in real trouble if the dollars and teeth didn't add up. You know how it is."
"I do."
"Still can't stay here talking all night. Got 60 more to do."
"Why should I know? Do what? Whom to?" said Susan.
"Children, of course. Can't disappoint them, can I? Imagine their little faces when they lift up their little pillows, bless them."
Ladder, pliers, teeth, money, pillows. "You don't expect me to believe you're the tooth fairy," said Susan suspiciously. She touched the ladder. It felt solid enough.
"Not thee," said the girl. "Ay, I'm surprised you don't know that."
She'd sauntered around the corner before Susan asked, "Why me?"
"'Cause she can tell," said a voice behind her. "Takes one to know one."
She turned. The raven was sitting in a small open window.
"You'd better come in," it said. "You can meet all sorts out in that alley."
"I already have." There was a brass plate screwed on the wall beside the door. It said, "C.V. Cheesewaller, D.M. Unseen, B. Thou, B.F." It was the first time Susan had ever heard metal speak.
"Simple trick," said the raven dismissively. "It senses you looking at it. Just give C.V. Cheesewaller, D.M. Unseen, B. Thou, B.F. Shut up, just give the door a push."
"It's locked." The raven gave her a beady-eyed look with its head on one side. Then it said,
That stops you. Ah, well, I'll fetch the key.
It appeared a moment later and dropped a large metal key onto the cobbles. Isn't the wizard in?
In, yes. In bed, snoring his head off.
I thought they stayed up all night.
Not this one. Cup of cocoa around 9, dead to the world at 5 past.
I can't just let myself into his house.
Why not? You've come to see me. Anyway, I'm the brains of the outfit. He just wears the funny hat and does the hand-waving.
Susan turned the key. It was warm inside. There was the usual wizardly paraphernalia. A forge, a bench with bottles and bundles strewn over it, a bookcase with books rammed in anyhow, a stuffed alligator hanging from the ceiling, some very big candles that were just lava streams of wax, and a raven on a skull.
"They get it all out of a catalogue," said the raven. "Believe me, it all comes in a big box. You think candles get dribbly like that by themselves? That's 3 days' work for a skilled candle dribbler."
"You're just making that up," said Susan. "Anyway, you can't just buy a skull."
"You know best, I'm sure, being educated," said the raven.
"What were you trying to tell me last night?"
"Tell you," said the raven, with a guilty look on its beak.
"All that da-da-da-da stuff." The raven scratched its head.
"He said I wasn't to tell you. I was just supposed to warn you about the horse. I got carried away. Turned up, has it?"
"Yes."
"Ride it?"
"I did. It can't be real. Real horses know where the ground is."
"Miss, there's no horse realer than that one."
"I know his name. I've ridden him before." The raven sighed, or at least made a sort of whistling noise which is as close to a sigh as a beak can get.
"Ride the horse. He's decided you're the one."
"Where to?"
"That's for me not to know, and you to find out."
"Just supposing I was stupid enough to do it, can you kind of hint about what will happen?"
"Well, you've read books, I can see. Have you ever read any about children who go to magical faraway kingdom and have adventures with goblins and so on?"
"Yes, of course," said Susan grimly.
"It'd probably be best if you thought along those lines," said the raven.
Susan picked up a bundle of herbs and played with them. "I saw someone outside who said she was the Tooth Fairy," she said.
"Nah, couldn't have been the Tooth Fairy," said the raven. "There's at least 3 of them."
"There's no such person. I mean, I didn't know. I thought that's just... it's a story, like the Sandman or the Hogfather." According to rural legend, at least in those areas where pigs are a vital part of the household economy, the Hogfather is a winter myth figure who on Hogswatch night gallops from house to house on a crude sledge drawn by 4 tusked wild boars to deliver presents of sausages, black puddings, pork scratchings and ham to all children who have been good. He says, "ho, ho, ho," a lot. Children who have been bad get a bag full of bloody bones. It's these little details which tell you it's a tale for the little folk. There is a song about him. It begins, "You'd better watch out." The Hogfather is said to have originated in the legend of a local king, who, one winter's night, happened to be passing, or so he said, the home of 3 young women, and heard them sobbing because they had no food to celebrate the midwinter feast. He took pity on them and threw a packet of sausages through the window, badly concussing one of them, but there's no point in spoiling a good legend.
"Ah," said the raven, "changing our tone, yes. Not so much of the emphatic declarative, yes. A bit less of the 'there's no such thing'. A bit more of a 'I didn't know', yes."
"Everyone knows. I mean, it's not logical that there's an old man in a beard who gives everyone sausages and chitterlings on Hogswatch night, is it?"
"I don't know about logic. Never learned about logic," said the raven. "Living on a skull ain't exactly logical, but that's what I do."
"And there can't be a sandman who goes around throwing sand in children's eyes," said Susan, but in tones of uncertainty. You'd never get enough sand in one bag."
"Could be, could be."
"I'd better be going," said Susan. "Miss Butts always checks the dorms on the stroke of midnight."
"How many dormitories are there?"
said the raven. "About 30, I think."
You believe she checks them all at midnight, and you don't believe in the Hog Father?
I'd better be going anyway, said Susan. Thank you.
Lock up behind you and chuck the key through the window, said the Raven.
The room was silent after she'd gone, except for the crackle as coals settled in the furnace. Then the skull said,
Kids today, eh?
I blame education, said the Raven.
A lot of knowledge is a dangerous thing, said the skull. A lot more dangerous than just a little. I always used to say that when I was alive.
When was that exactly?
Can't remember. I think I was pretty knowledgeable. Probably a teacher or philosopher, something of that kidney. And now I'm on a bench with a bird crapping on my head.
Very allegorical, said the Raven.
No one had taught Susan about the power of belief, or at least about the power of belief in a combination of high magical potential and low reality stability such as existed on the Discworld. Belief makes a hollow place. Something has to roll in to fill it. Which is not to say that belief denies logic. For example, it's fairly obvious that the Sandman needs only a small sack. On the Discworld, he doesn't bother to take the sand out first. It was almost midnight. Susan crept into the stables. She was one of those people who will not leave a mystery unsolved. The ponies were silent in the presence of Binky. The horse glowed in the darkness. Susan heaved a saddle down from the rack, and then thought better of it. If she was going to fall off, a saddle wouldn't be any help, and reins would be about as much use as a rudder on a rock. She opened the door to the loose box. Most horses won't walk backwards voluntarily, because what they can't see doesn't exist. But Binky shuffled out by himself, and walked over to the mounting block where he turned and watched her expectantly. Susan climbed onto his back. It was like sitting on a table.
All right, she whispered. I don't have to believe any of this, mind you.
Binky lowered his head and whinnied. Then he trotted out into the yard and headed for the field. At the gate he broke into a canter and turned towards the fence. Susan shut her eyes. She felt muscles bunch under the velvet skin, and then the horse was rising, over the fence, over the field. Behind it, in the turf, two fiery hoofprints burned for a second or two. As she passed above the school, she saw a light flicker in a window. Miss Butts was on her rounds.
There's going to be trouble over this, Susan told herself.
And then she thought, I'm on the back of a horse 100 feet up in the air, being taken somewhere mysterious that's a bit like a magic land with goblins and talking animals. There's only so much more trouble I could get into. Besides, is riding a flying horse against school rules? I bet it's not written down anywhere. Quirm vanished beneath her, and the world opened up in a pattern of darkness and moonlight silver. A checkerboard pattern of fields strobed by in the moonlight, with the occasional light of an isolated farm. Ragged clouds whipped past and away. Away on her left, the Ramtop Mountains were a cold, white wall. On her right, the rim ocean carried a pathway to the moon. There was no wind, or even a great sensation of speed, just the land flashing by and the long, slow strides of Binky. And then someone spilled gold on the night. Clouds parted in front of her, and there, spread below, was Ankh Morpork, a city containing more peril than even Miss Butts could imagine. Torchlight outlined a pattern of streets in which Quirm would have not only been lost, but mugged and pushed into the river as well. Binky cantered easily over the rooftops. Susan could hear the sounds of the streets, even individual voices, but there was also the great roar of the city, like some kind of insect hive. Upper windows drifted by, each one a glow of candlelight. The horse dropped through the smoky air and landed neatly at the trot in an alley which was otherwise empty, except for a closed door and a sign with a torch over it. Susan read, Curry Gardens. Kitchren Entlance. Keep out. This means you. Binky seemed to be waiting for something. Susan had expected a more exotic destination. She knew about curry. They had curry at school, under the name of bogey and rice. It was yellow. There were soggy raisins and peas in it. Binky whinnied and stamped a hoof. A hatch in the door flew open. Susan got a brief impression of a face against the fiery atmosphere of the kitchen.
Oh! no! Binker!
The hatch slammed shut again. Obviously, something was meant to happen. She stared at a menu nailed to the wall. It was misspelled, of course, because the menu of the folkier kind of restaurant always has to have misspellings in it, so that customers can be lured into a false sense of superiority. She couldn't recognize the names of most of the dishes, which included curry with vegetable, 8p, curry with sweat and sore balls of pig, 10p, curry with sweer and sour ball of fish, 10p, curry with meat, 10p, curry with named meat, 15p, extra curry, 5p, prawn cracker, 4p, eat it here or take it away. The hatch snapped open again, and a large brown bag of allegedly but not really waterproof paper was dumped on the little ledge in front of it. Then the hatch slammed shut again. Susan reached out carefully. The smell rising from the bag had a sort of thermic lance quality that warned against metal cutlery. But tea had been a long time ago. She realized she didn't have any money on her. On the other hand, no one had asked her for any. But the world would go to rack and ruin if people didn't recognize their responsibilities. She leaned forward and knocked on the door. "Excuse me, don't you want anything?" There was a shouting and a crash from inside, as if half a dozen people were fighting to get under the same table. "Oh, how nice, thank you. Thank you very much," said Susan politely. Binky walked away slowly. This time there was no bunched leap of muscle power. He trotted into the air carefully, as if some time in the past he'd been scolded for spilling something. Susan tried the curry, several hundred feet above the speeding landscape, and then threw it away as politely as possible.
"It was very unusual," she said. "And that's it? You carried me all the way up here for takeaway food?"
The ground skimmed past faster, and it crept over her that the horse was going a lot faster now, a full gallop instead of the easy canter, a bunching of muscle. And then the sky ahead of her erupted blue for a moment. Behind her, unseen because light was standing around red with embarrassment, asking itself what had happened, a pair of hoofprints burned in the air for a moment. It was a landscape hanging in space. There was a squat little house with a garden around it. There were fields and distant mountains. Susan stared at it as Binky slowed. There was no depth. As the horse swung around for a landing, the landscape was revealed as a mere surface, a thin-shaped film of existence imposed on nothingness. She expected it to tear where the horse landed, but there was only a faint crunch and a scatter of gravel. Binky trotted around the house and into the stable yard where he stood and waited. Susan got off gingerly. The ground felt solid enough under her feet. She reached down and scratched at the gravel. There was more gravel underneath. She'd heard that the tooth fairy collected teeth. Think about it logically, the only other people who collected any bits of bodies did so for very suspicious purposes, and usually to harm or control other people. The tooth fairies must have half the children in the world under their control, and this didn't look like the house of that sort of person. The hog father apparently lived in some kind of horrible slaughterhouse in the mountains, festooned with sausages and black puddings, and painted a terrible blood red, which suggested style. A nasty style, but at least style of a sort. This place didn't have style of any sort. The Soul Cake Tuesday duck didn't apparently have any kind of a home, nor did Old Man Trouble, or the Sandman, as far as she knew. She walked around the house, which wasn't much larger than a cottage, definitely. Whoever lived here had no taste at all. She found the front door. It was black, with a knocker in the shape of an omega. Susan reached for it, but the door opened by itself, and the hall stretched away in front of her, far bigger than the outside of the house could possibly contain. She could distantly make out a stairway wide enough for the tap-dancing finale in a musical. There was something else wrong with the perspective. There clearly was a wall a long way off, but at the same time it looked as though it was painted in the air a mere 15 feet or so away. It was as if distance was optional. There was a large clock against one wall. Its slow tick filled the immense space. "There's a room," she thought. "I remember, the Room of Whispers." Doors lined the hall at wide intervals, or short intervals, if you looked at it another way. She tried to walk towards the nearest one and gave up after a few wildly teetering steps. Finally, she managed to reach it by taking aim and then shutting her eyes. The door was at one and the same time about normal human size and immensely big. There was a highly ornate frame around it with a skulls and bones motif. She pushed the door open. This room could have housed a small town. A small area of carpet occupied the middle distance, no more than a hectare in size. It took Susan several minutes to reach the edge. It was a room within a room. There was a large, heavy-looking desk on a raised dais, with a leather swivel chair behind it. There was a large model of the Discworld on a sort of ornament made of four elephants standing on the shell of a turtle. There were several bookshelves, the large volumes piled in the haphazard fashion of people who are far too busy using the books ever to arrange them properly. There was even a window, hanging in the air a few feet above the ground. But there were no walls. There was nothing between the edge of the carpet and the walls of the greater room, except floor. And even that was far too precise a word for it. It didn't look like rock, and it certainly wasn't wood. It made no sound when Susan walked on it. It was simply surface, in the purely geometrical sense. The carpet had a skull and bones pattern. It was also black. Everything was black, or a shade of grey. Here and there a tint suggested a very deep purple, or ocean-depth blue. In the distance, towards the walls of the greater room, the meta-room, or whatever it was, there was a suggestion of something. Something was casting complicated shadows, too far away to be clearly seen. Susan got up onto the dais. There was something odd about the things around her. Of course, there was everything odd about the things around her, but it was a huge, major oddness that was simply in their nature. She could ignore it. But there was an oddness on a human level. Everything was just slightly wrong, as if it had been made by someone who hadn't fully comprehended its purpose. There was a blotter on the oversized desk, but it was part of it, fused to the surface. The drawers were just raised areas of wood, impossible to open. Whoever had made the desk had seen desks, but hadn't understood deskishness. There was even some sort of desk ornament. It was just a slab of lead with a thread hanging down one side and a shiny round metal ball on the end of the thread. If you raised the ball, it swung down and thumped into the lead, just once. She didn't try to sit in the chair. There was a deep pit in the leather. Someone had spent a lot of time sitting there. She glanced at the spines of the books. They were in a language she couldn't understand. She trekked back to the distant door, went out into the hall and tried the next door. A suspicion was beginning to form in her mind. The door led to another huge room, but this one was full of shelves, floor to distant, cloud-hung ceiling. Every shelf was lined with hourglasses. The sand pouring from the past to the future filled the room with a sound like surf, a noise made up of a billion small sounds. Susan walked between the shelves. It was like being in a crowd. Her eye was caught by a movement on a nearby shelf. In most of the hourglasses, the falling sand was a solid silver line, but in this one, just as she watched, the line vanished. The last grain of sand tumbled into the bottom bulb. The hourglass vanished with a small pop. A moment later, another one appeared in its place, with the faintest of pings. In front of her eyes, sand began to fall. And she was aware that this process was going on all over the room. Old hourglasses vanished, new ones took their place. She knew about this, too. She reached out and picked up a glass, bit her lip thoughtfully, and started to turn the thing upside down. Squeak! She spun round. The Death of Rats was on the shelf behind her. It raised an admonitory finger. All right, said Susan. She put the glass back in its place. Squeak!
No, I haven't finished looking.
Susan set off for the door, with the rat skittering across the floor after her. The third room turned out to be the bathroom. Susan hesitated. You expected hourglasses in this place. You expected the skull and bones motif. But you didn't expect the very large white porcelain tub, on its own raised podium, like a throne, with giant brass taps, and in faded blue letters just over the thing that held the plug chain, the words, C.H. Lavatory and Son, Mollymog Street, Ankh-Morpork. You didn't expect the rubber duck. It was yellow. You didn't expect the soap. It was suitably bone white, but looked as if it had never been used. Beside it was a bar of orange soap, which certainly had been used. It was hardly more than a sliver. It smelled a lot like the vicious stuff used at school. The bath, though big, was a human thing. There was brown-lined crazing around the plug hole, and a stain where the tap had dripped, but almost everything else had been designed by the person who hadn't understood deskishness, and now hadn't understood ablutionology either. They'd created a towel rail an entire athletics team could have used for training. The black towels on it were fused onto it and were quite hard. Whoever actually used the bathroom probably dried themselves on the white and blue very worn towel with the initials YMRCIGBSAAM on it. There was even a lavatory, another fine example of C.H. Lavatory's porcelainic art, with the embossed frieze of green and blue flowers on the cistern. And again, like the bath and the soap, it suggested that this room had been built by someone, and then someone else had come along afterwards to add small details. Someone with a better knowledge of plumbing, for a start. And someone else who understood, really understood, that towels should be soft, and capable of drying people, and soap should be capable of bubbles. You didn't expect any of it until you saw it, and then it was like seeing it again. The bald towel dropped off the rail and skipped across the floor until it fell away to reveal the death of rats.
Squeak!
Oh, all right, said Susan. Where do you want me to go now? The rat scurried to the open door and disappeared into the hall. Susan followed it to yet another door. She turned yet another handle. Another room within a room lay beyond. There was a tiny area of lighted tiling in the darkness containing the distant vision of a table, a few chairs, a kitchen dresser, and someone. A hunched figure was sitting at the table. As Susan cautiously approached, she heard the clink of cutlery on a plate. An old man was eating his supper very noisily. In between forkfuls, he was talking to himself with his mouth full. It was a kind of auto-bad manners.
"'It's not my fault, Spray. I was against it from the start, but, ah, no, he has to go and
recover piece of ballistic sausage from table.
Start getting involved. I told him, it's not as if you're not involved.'
Stab unidentified fried object.
Oh, no, that's not his way.
Spray, jab fork in the air.
Once you get involved like that, I said, how are you getting out? Tell me that.
Make temporary egg and ketchup sandwich.
But, oh, no.
Susan walked around the patch of carpet. The man took no notice. The death of rats shinned up the table leg and landed on a slice of fried bread.
"'Oh, it's you. Squeak!'
The old man looked around.
"'Where? Where?'
Susan stepped onto the carpet. The man stood up so quickly that his chair fell over.
"'Who the hell's are you?'
"'Could you stop pointing that sharp bacon at me?'
"'I ask you a question, young woman.'
"'I'm Susan.'
This didn't sound enough.
"'Duchess of Stowhelit,' she added.
The man's wrinkled face wrinkled still further as he strove to comprehend this. Then he turned away and threw his hands up in the air.
"'Oh, yes,'
he bawled to the room in general.
"'That just puts the entire tin lid on it, that does.'
He waved a finger at the death of rats, who leaned backwards.
"'You cheating little rodent! Oh, yes, I smell a rat here.'
"'Squeak?'
The shaking finger stopped suddenly. The man spun around.
"'How did you manage to walk through the wall?'
"'I'm sorry,' said Susan, backing away. "'I didn't know there was one.'
"'What do you call this thing? Clatchian mist?'
The man slapped the air. The hippo of memory wallowed.
"'Albert,' said Susan.
"'Right?' Albert thumped his forehead with the palm of his hand.
"'Worse and worse! What have you been telling her?